Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point, live from Shanghai. For three decades now, the number one goal of China has been hyper-growth and development. More towers, like these going up in Shanghai. More factories, more power plants, more coal. And in growth, China has succeeded. But the price has been something approaching environmental catastrophe. Can China stop the spiral? It's not clear. This hour, On Point, we'll look at China's environmental crisis and talk to three people inside China trying to take their country in a new and greener direction. For great detail on China's environmental challenge and all of our week in Shanghai, go to our website, onpointradio.org/China. Joining me first today from Hong Kong is an extraordinary woman. The Atlanta Journal-Constitution calls her China's Erin Brockovich. Zhang Jingjing is Director of Litigation at the Center for Legal Assistance to Pollution Victims, based in Beijing. The center is China's first pro bono environmental aid office. In 2004, she won China's first ever public hearing for an environmental lawsuit in a case against a Beijing state-owned power company. In 2006, she was part of a team of lawyers that won one of the biggest legal settlements in Chinese history for 1,600 villagers whose water had been poisoned by a chemical factory dumping chromium. She's a hero to some and a pain to others. Zhang Jingjing in Hong Kong, thank you very much for joining us.
Hello, Tom. I'm delighted to be invited to join this conversation and share with the audience and other people with my experience as an environmental lawyer in China.
It's great to have you. All Americans will know the story of Erin Brockovich, who fought for the environment in California. Not so many will know your story. You must be very brave to be an advocate for the environment in a country that has been so focused on industrial growth.
I think it's not because I'm not only because I am brave. I think the people who suffered pollution, they are brave and they are trying to use the legal means to fight against the polluters and protect themselves.
What is it like, Zhang Jingjing, in China to go into a town and take on a major, let's say, factory in that town? I mean, we know that growth has been a big priority for China. And, of course, China was poor. It needed to develop. But we understand that the Communist Party is very often a big supporter of this growth. And quite often the party is cooperating with the local industry to have as much output as they can. When you come to town, threatening perhaps a lawsuit, maybe even to shut a factory down, what kind of response do you get from the local factory owners?
The lawyer for the plaintiff and the lawyer for the people who suffer the pollution, the defendant, the polluter, the factories are not welcome me. We have this legal means. We have a court to give us legal relief. So I help the people use the litigation to help their individual rights. Recently our government realized the environmental protection is a very very important issue as well as the development. So from the central government, I think the central government take measures try to solve this environmental crisis. But for the local level, like in a town, in a county, sure, the factory is can distribute their financial income to the local government. So the local government have a natural tendency to protect the polluter, the factories. We are trying to fight against the pollution, and the people try to fight against the pollution.
And we know that many Chinese people have stood up to complain about environmental problems, especially in recent years, a growing number of protests about this because the impact is simply so heavy. I'm reading here, pollution has made cancer China's leading cause of death. What ambient air pollution alone responsible for hundreds of thousands of deaths every year, nearly half a billion people without access to safe drinking water in China. Zhang Jingjing, how do you find out? It's such a big country, 1.3 billion people, a very large nation with lots of industry at this point. How do you learn about a particular problem in a particular community? How does it come to your attention?
In my center, we established a hotline and gave us free legal advice to the people who called us. And from this phone call, we know this problem in certain place, and I was sent lawyer to investigate these problems. Once we think that a case is worth taking, I will help the community and the villagers to file a litigation in the court. But from 1999 to today, my center answered more than 10,000 phone calls about pollution, and we wrote more than 400 letters on legal advice, and we help the people file more than 120 litigation in the court.
What has been your success rate out of those 120 cases? How many have you won?
I think one-third cases we won, not only in the courtroom. Sometimes we lost in the court, but we can get a settlement to be outside the court. And the biggest victory happened in 2005. We won a compensation for 1,721 villagers in Fujian province. We successfully won that case, and the villagers got the compensation this year.
Could you describe that case for us? This was the Rongping Lianying Chemical Factory in Fujian province. They were dumping chromium into the local water supply. Was that a river or a lake? And did the villagers know what was going on?
Actually, it's air pollution and water pollution and solid pollution damaged the villagers' bamboo and rice, vegetables, and also drinking water. And they send us mainly petition letters to the local government and to the provincial government, but there's no any response. And they send many letters to media. And the one journalist found us, and we sent scientists and a lawyer and a student to investigate that case. And we successfully filed litigation in 2001. And that litigation lasted almost 5 years and experienced two trial and appeal. And finally, we won in the Fujian Provincial High Court in 2005. And we won the compensation for the villagers. And we also won remediation for the village. And the court ordered an injunction, asked the polluter, the factory, the chemical factory, to clean up that solid waste dumping.
That's an important victory, but it's one victory in a very, very large country. Does it send a message to other factories to clean up, or do you think they still feel largely free to pollute the air and water in their area and far beyond?
Yeah, it's only one successful case in one province, but that case attracted a lot of attention from all over the country. After we won that case, many farmers and fishermen sent a message or called us. They want our help, and I think that case raised the public's awareness about environmental litigation and give them hope to see we still have hope. We can use litigation to protect ourselves, and also send the message to the polluters, to the factories, and to tell them if you violate environmental law, you will take the responsibility to your violation.
And yet, Zhang Jingjing, China is still growing at double-digit rates, very, very high rates of growth. We read about dirty factories being brought into China in past years, sort of importing the world's pollution to this country. Do you feel that overall China is making progress, or is it becoming dirtier as its growth continues to roar ahead at such a great pace?
I cannot see the whole environment get better, but we did take measure. Our government did take measure to control the pollution. But as you know, the Roma wasn't built in one day, and so the process will take long time.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point, live from Shanghai. We're talking this hour about China's astounding environmental crisis, whether the country can manage it, and its implications for China and for the world. Things have gotten very, very bad in China. Of course, the U.S. can hardly throw stones on many fronts. It has been the leading emissions producer in the world for a long, long time. But estimates now that China may have already passed the United States as number one in emissions and on many other fronts, particulate pollution coming all the way into Los Angeles, South Korea, Tokyo, from China. The pollution that happens in China travels around the world. It has a great effect, of course, right in the backyard of Chinese citizens. They've been standing up. In June last year, thousands of protesters marched against government plans to build a new chemical plant in Xiamen in southeast China. Let's listen. It takes a lot to get people out in the streets like that in China. There were plans to build a plant that would make paraxylene, PX, petrochemical used in polyester, maybe in the clothes you would have worn. They were put on hold by the government after the protest just last month. They said the plant would not be built in Xiamen. But there are many, many other factories that have gone up and continue to go up around China, some clean, many not. Some of the world's dirtiest factories have been shipped to China as Western countries try to get rid of that pollution, China picking up so much industrialization that it ends up in China's backyard. You can join the conversation this hour behind its hypergrowth. Have you seen the price environmental devastation extracts from China's people, their health and lives? And can China change, or is it too invested in growth at any cost? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been joined from Hong Kong by Zhang Jingjing. She's been called China's Erin Brockovich. She's director of litigation at the Center for Legal Assistance to Pollution Victims. It's China's first pro bono environmental aid office. They and she have won some very important cases in China's legal system, but it's not easy. We're joined as well now by a couple of other great authorities on the Chinese environment. With me here in our On Point studio in Shanghai is Yang Fucheng. He is vice president of the Energy Foundation, a group that with offices in the U.S. and China that funds initiatives to advance energy efficiency, renewable energy. He's been involved in energy and environmental issues for more than three decades. Yang Fucheng, thank you very much for coming in.
Hi, Tom. I'm glad to be part of this program.
It's very good to have you. And from Beijing, we're joined by Qi Ye. He's a distinguished professor of environmental policy and management at Tsinghua University School of Public Policy and Management. He was part of the environmental task force that in 2006 called for major changes in governance in China to address the country's growing environmental problems. In Beijing, Qi Ye, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here with you.
Qi, I wish you'd help us just by jumping in first with a kind of broad description of what's going on with this environment. The New York Times ran a big series last year, Choking on Success. It laid out in excruciating detail the scale and depth of the environmental problem. Do you see China turning the tide against that problem, or is it still growing as China's growth continues?
Well, this is a result of this very rapid development in the last 3 decades. And this trend of growth, double-digit growth, is still continuing. And I think the environment will continue to get worse before it's getting better. And that being said, and as Jiang Jingjing pointed out earlier, the government and all different sectors in the nation been trying very hard to really trying to turn the tide, and it will take some time.
Yang Fuchen, we read that whatever Beijing may decide or whatever they may try to promulgate as policy, it's hard for them to enforce that policy all the way down to the local level, where local officials are often very closely connected with local industrialists and factory owners. Does the central government in China, powerful as it is, have enough power to turn around this tide of environmental destruction in this country?
Yeah, my answer is yes or no. The yes is that you understand in China, the central government have a very strong power, much powerful the establish the population policy regulation, and they ask the local government to follow their directions. But on the other hand, because China is a decentralization, they give a more power for the local. And local officials now, they focus on the GDP growth as a first. So they
and they're rewarded for that, or have been, ever since Deng Xiaoping. When they get higher growth, they get promotions.
Yeah, that is why the Chinese GDP grows so fast, two digits. So that's why decentralization is good. But however, we have to understand decentralization have bring some negative, and that means for the local government, before they didn't pay attention to the environment and energy issues like energy efficiency and renewables.
Zhang Jingjing, you're often out in local communities fighting the fight. Do you see local officials feeling responsible to Beijing, or do they try and lean away from Beijing's directives to clean up? Do they try and hide their problems or just duck the new policies?
Yeah, they have many stories. Some local governments, and actually they follow the direction of the central government. But a large part of the officials, they try to say, okay, now I'd like to develop a more local economy and have a higher employee rate. And they try to cover some bad stories. And so they have and they say, okay, I listen, but they're doing something is something else.
Zhang Jingjing, in Hong Kong, have you seen examples of that kind of behavior?
I can see from the judge's attitude to the case, and I know the judge have a big pressure from the local government. Like one of my case in Beijing about a power line, whether or not that power line should build, and I learned from the judge, he told me he cannot make a final decision because the local municipal government make the decision. They give the judge, the court, the trial court and the appeal court a lot of pressure, ask them close that case before certain day. So from the judge's attitude, I know the local government have this tendency to avoid the environmental policy and the environmental law from the central government and our NPC, our National Congress.
Zhang Jingjing, we have a lot of callers who want to join this conversation from the United States here in Shanghai. Let's begin to hear from them. From Boston, Jim is calling. Hi, Jim. You're on the line to Shanghai. It's good to have you. What do you know?
Hi, Tom. I just returned Monday from a week in Shanghai. It's my second trip to Shanghai in 3 years and actually third trip to China in that time span. In the Pudong area, I was pretty surprised at the amount of growth just in that one area, just in a few years.
It's amazing, isn't it? And that financial center with that skyline, it's really something to see.
Standing across the river, there was a pretty big change just in a couple of years since I've been there. But the pollution is a major factor. And being there a week, I never saw a blue sky even on a clear day. And in fact, I don't think I've ever seen a blue sky in any of my trips to China. It's always kind of a mottled color or a, maybe an orange or a, there's definitely no blue sky. And in driving down the street in a bus or a cab or whatever, you're breathing in just the amount of matter in the air is incredible. The first thing, I couldn't wait to get home and just go for a walk around here to try and clean my lungs out. You can almost taste it. You can feel it all around you. The government, being a central government, really has to step in, and where they are the ultimate authority, they have to do something about it. It's
Jim, do you think China can keep up that, you know, burning hot growth rate and deal with the environmental problem? Do they have any choice but to grow fast? They've got 1.3 billion people that don't want to be poor.
I don't think they really have a choice. It's going to be an environmental disaster waiting to happen if they continue to develop rampantly with no environmental limits or no real environmental controls. You look at the canals and the rivers, in the air quality, it's really, the people are going to be in pretty dire straits health-wise. That's going to put a bigger burden on their economy as far as trying to take care of their people with cancer and respiratory problems and just all this stuff. You almost feel as if it envelops you. You know, people over there, if they haven't been out, they may not really realize it, but somebody who comes from the West, comes from somewhere with, you know, at least in theory, clean air, it's literally something tangible that's in the air. And again, the government really has to step up. They have to try and rein it in. They have
Jim,
to do something.
We hear it. We hear it loud and clear. In fairness, I have to say, though we've had a bunch of gray days, we've got blue sky here in Shanghai today. So it does happen sometimes. But, you know, we know it's bad. Zhang Jingjing in Hong Kong, you've described how exactly what Jim is referring to, where people, if they grow up in an environment that's very polluted, they may not even know what a clean environment should feel and look like. You had that experience yourself, I've read, as a girl. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I grew up in a community close to a state-owned chemical factory, and both of my parents worked in that factory. I saw this red and brown water discharged from the chemical factory every day. I got used to it. So one day when I left my hometown, when I went to university, I realized that we can have a different environment, cleaner and more beautiful, more natural environment. So from that time, I think I will do something for a better environment.
Chiyu, how big is this problem, and has the government begun to really address it? We read that last year President Hu Jintao tried to push a new program called Green GDP, where they would recalculate the gross domestic product to reflect the cost of pollution. And we read that when they did that in some provinces in China, the pollution-adjusted growth rates were almost zero when you really considered the cost of the environmental damage. But yet when he tried to push a program through to do this nationally, I guess it was refused. So is Beijing having success in bringing new policies, or is it stuck?
Well, this concept of green GDP basically means you take away the environmental damage from the economic growth, from the normal, the regular GDP, then what you get is a so-called green GDP. This is a very interesting scientific concept, but when you try to apply such a concept and to use the green GDP as a indicator, as an index to measure local government performance, it is not really fair to them, simply because technically we do not really have an accurate, precise method to actually measure the green GDP. So it is a great idea, but it faces a lot of difficulty. Yes, indeed, because of this and for some other reasons, the local government do not really like to be measured with the green GDP. By the way, the Chinese government, the central government, has never tried, as a central government, tried to apply this to the local government. So it is fair to say, the resistance to this is really on the conceptual level. And because this never happened, never applied to the local government, this is right. This is something that the new ministry of environmental protection trying to apply, but didn't really go through.
Let's take a call from Chris in Boston. Hi, Chris. You're on the air via Shanghai.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. I just called because several years ago I made a film for the PBS series Nova, specifically that dealt with the problem of affluence creating environmental problems and air problems. And while I was in Beijing in particular, there was a lot of discussion about how the Chinese government was retrofitting all of the public buildings to burn natural gas instead of coal, and specifically trying to clean the air up before the Beijing Olympics, which are now upon us. And I'm just sort of curious to hear whether or not that effort had any impact, now 4 years later, and what what the air is like these days.
Chris, let us pick that up. Yang Fucheng, of course, the Chinese government has really increased its efforts dramatically in these last 4 years as the Olympics have come closer. How's that going? We've read just in the last few days they've got special orders out to shut down all kinds of factories and even spray painting before the Olympics begin. But it's a huge challenge. Are they going to, what kind of air quality do you think they're going to be able to deliver in August this year?
Yeah, for the Beijing administration, they take a lot of measures to clean the air up. And for example, they burn the natural gas to replace the coal. I stay in Beijing for 8 years. Mm-hmm. So every year I can see the improvements. And here you understand China now, they burn the coal very much, but they have not enough resources of natural gas. But now they develop more and will import more LNG in China. So I think that is can change the fuel type, actually can make a big contribution for air quality.
Chiye, you're there in Beijing. We know China has 40% of the world's coal consumption. That's a pretty tremendous quantity and no small amount around Beijing. What do you expect athletes will find when they arrive in August when it comes to air quality? We've read all kinds of reports about how it may affect performance. People want to wear masks and all the rest. Is the Beijing government managing to push back, if only temporarily, that pollution?
Well, like Dr. Yang Fucheng just mentioned, in the last couple of years, ever since 1998, the air quality has been in a steady improving pace. And I think the athletes will come over here with a surprise that it is actually not as bad as they have heard. And I have been observing the air quality, and I can assure you, and the athletes, and everyone who are concerned, it should be no problem.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about China's really enormous environmental crisis right now, whether that country can manage it, and the implications of that crisis for China and for the world. What about the sort of global responsibility here in moving all of its manufacturing, or so much, to China? Electronics, toys, clothing, and so much more. Has the world exported its pollution problems to China as well? Do you think China can change, or is it too invested in growth at any cost as it tries to go at breakneck speed to raise its standard of living very quickly? We're joined this hour from Hong Kong by Zhang Jingjing. She's been called China's Erin Brockovich. She's out there in villages, towns, and cities around the country fighting battle after battle, and she's had some victories. In Beijing, we're joined by Qi Yue. He's a professor at Tsinghua University, been very involved in tracking how Chinese governance may play a role in how China's environmental situation unfolds. And with me in our studios in Shanghai, Yang Fuqiang, he's with the Energy Foundation. They look at ways to do things better. Let's take a call from Bruce in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, everybody, and thank you guys for fighting the good fight. My question is, what kind of predictions or analyses have been made on what I guess you could call is the end game if things keep moving as they seem to be? Because the Beijing Olympics is, you know, a response to an acute issue right now. But what's going to happen when everybody runs out of water, for example? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Yang Fucheng, how about it? We know China has very, very serious water problems, areas where they used to be able to dig down with a shovel to get the water. Now they're having to get in very sophisticated equipment, areas that are just drying up where they can't plant their grains. Water being sucked into Beijing as it's gone from 7 to 17 million people. What about the long-term environmental picture for China? If it, by its own planning, needs a few decades more rapid growth, what does it end up with environmentally at the end of that?
Yeah, if we assume everything, it doesn't change, so we can see that water, the air quality is get worse. So what we can do? We have to say we have to balance economic growth and environment and energy supply. So here you just talk China for CO2 emissions and will pass the U.S. very soon, or maybe this year or next year. Will be number one CO2 emitters in the world, so they have a very strong impact on the climate change. For the water, because climate change, you can see the water supply become less and less. So Himalaya, the mountain glacier, now is melting. So we think that will hurt. It's not only for Chinese people, but for other countries in the Southeast countries. So we think that is a very serious problem. That is in about 400 million people will suffer the water supply shortage. For energy, if they don't, you know, change to improve the energy efficiency and use the more renewables, and we will see even in China, they have not enough energy supply. They have to go out to import more natural gas or energy resources. And that is impossible because, you know, other countries, they have to use energy also. So the key question is that we have to balance. So now Chinese central government have provided a very significant measure. We call the 20% energy reduction and 10% major pollutant cut.
Are factories following that around the country, or is it just a goal? I mean, what we read is that Beijing puts numbers out, puts target goals out, but they don't get met because they just don't get compliance from below. And, you know, there's two at the local level, the party may be so wrapped up with industry that they're not really going to push it.
Yeah, that's a good question. And because this is a national target, they disaggregate to the local and to the sector, even to the, you know, big enterprises, and they have to sign a contract to the government. And for instance, for the state-owned enterprises, if manager didn't reach these targets, and they cannot be promoted.
Qi Yue, in Beijing, lots of Western countries have been through this cycle at some point in their history of dirty industrialization, later cleaned up when they became wealthier. And I've heard just in this week Chinese officials talk about the same thing, saying, look, we can't deal with it now. We'll deal with it later. We need to become rich. We need to become a first world country. Then we'll clean it up. But if that takes 30 or 40 more years, if China's so lucky to stay on that path, what kind of environment will the country have? And can they really wait that long to clean it up? Are the kinds of steps that Yang Fuqiang is talking about enough at this point to stop the degradation in the meantime?
Well, just last week, the U.S. EPA Consul General, Dr. Roger Metella, showed us a picture, 1930s, in New York City, and where you find this filthy air. And also, when I was in Boston and a professor in the Kennedy School, and his name, Professor Dr. Leonard, told me the story, you know, back in 1970s and 1960s, and you're looking at the Charles River, not only the water and also the air is all filled with a lot of different kind of pollutant. And this is exactly what we here in China are experiencing. And as an overall trend, the environment get worse before getting better. I mean, this is true in most of places. And the question is, you know, how much worse it will get. And we're not so sure. But I want to communicate with the American public, the audience. And, you know, in terms of energy, we use a lot of energy imported and also domestic. Use this energy to manufacture goods and services. And as much as 20% of all the energy uses we use here in China is actually for manufacturing goods and services for exporting to the United States. So basically, in China, this is a result of a globalization, this overall trend of globalization in the economy. So, you know, as it goes, and I think it will probably continue to get worse, but I do not know how much worse it will get. But to solve this problem, it takes not only the effort from China, but also it's becoming a global problem, and it takes a global cooperation and effort to solve the problem.
What are you suggesting there, that China should send those manufacturing jobs and their pollution back to the United States or back to Europe?
Well, of course, that will not happen, as we know. But some of those manufacturing jobs will certainly go to some other places, maybe not back to the U.S. or Europe. And what I'm saying is it takes a global effort. You know, China, U.S., Europe, and Japan, and we work together, and we have to face the problem. It's not just a problem of one country, and it is a problem we all commonly face. So, like things like a technology transfer to make energy saving, energy efficiency, and to work on cleaning up the water and the air, I think it really takes a tremendous effort. This is a very big problem. And what I'm saying here, it's very important for all of us to work together.
But nobody else is going to be able to solve China's internal problem if China doesn't or can't solve it itself. Let me take a call from Aiken, South Carolina, and James. James, you're on the line to Shanghai.
Yes, good morning. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
My experience is in plant design and startup and operation in many countries around the world. And
What kind of plant, James?
Plants and yes. Power plants. Mm-hmm. And I really have a comment rather than a question.
Okay.
My experience is that the plants will get built to satisfy the local requirements for environmental insult. And when those requirements become high quality, shall we say, meaning low impact, low insult, then the plants are built that way. And what we found, what I believe has been the case in the Western world, is that the economies haven't been adversely impacted as these requirements have increased. Rather, the types of jobs that have been created have changed. And instead of having plant operators as your major wage earner, you start building design and construction of all the extra equipment that is required to meet these operations. So
what's your advice, James, to China? Just raise the standards that are required of new plants and everything will be fine?
I think at the moment they've experienced a growth largely because they have falsely, I'm going to use the word falsely, it's charged, I know, they have falsely low operating costs because they haven't had these requirements. And so, the people that are shipping all their jobs overseas, all their operations, like the United States, have no requirements that, for instance, the same standards of environmental protection be used. So even if in China they raise their rates or their requirements, and if the Chinese people only export it over to Burma or someplace like that, then they're not going to do any good. Now, one of the reasons that countries like Japan and Korea can do so well in competition with the United States is that they're building brand new plant, which automatically is going to have lower operating costs per unit than the older plants in the rest of the world.
James, you clearly know of what you speak. I want to put it to our Chinese guests here while we're lucky enough to have them, and thank you for your call. Yangfu Chan, how about it? James has installed power plants all around the world. He says if you want a cleaner environment, raise your standards and pay for it. Your products may not be quite as cheap. You may not be able to draw in as much of the world's manufacturing, but you'll have a better environment, and ultimately everyone's better off. Can China really afford to do that and still maintain the growth that's required to keep everybody happy here and, the party in charge?
Yeah, my answer simply yes.
Isn't it doing it then?
The question is that as the central government, they have established standards. It's not say there are no standards for the power plant. The question is the implementation and enforcement. So we have to send people to, use the technology, online, the monitoring to see the power plant follow this standard or not. Mm-hmm. So I think that is very important. And recently, I would like to add is China actually built a more advanced technology coal-fired power plant, and we call it actual supercritical power plant. Mm-hmm. And the efficiency can reach to 45%, and is more than 5 or 6 points higher than the conventional power plant.
But I also read China's adding something like a new coal plant almost every day.
Yeah, every day. Last year, 2007, actually they installed more than 100 gigawatts. That is 2 UK total capacity.
Are those state-of-the-art, scrubbing facilities with the cleanest possible exhaust from fired coal or not?
So yeah, that's a good question. And I will think is one third of the new power plant actually is pretty good. Is the most advanced technology in the world, but still one third is local. If local they build, they still trying to because the electricity supply shortage. They build a small one and then quick up to supply provide electricity.
They need it and they build it quick and they get the power that they need, but then they get...
Yeah, the coal size is small, of course. That is a heavy
point. Zhang Jingjing, when you're out and around in China fighting these legal cases, what's your overall impression? Do you feel some confidence that China will get on top of its environmental problem before it gets even worse? Do you think it will get worse before it gets better? And if it does, is that tolerable to, the price to Chinese citizens and for that matter, the price to global warming in the world?
I think we should be optimistic because the general public, the people realize their rights and they want help the government to solve this environmental crisis. And I hope our government will let the people join with all these government agencies to protect our environment. Once we can achieve this, once we can use the public as a power to control the pollution, I think we have a hope to solve this pollution.
Let's take a call from Natick, Massachusetts, and Janet. Hi, Janet, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Wonderful program.
My
question is regarding life expectancy. In the early 90s, I was proofreading some publications at Harvard Business School, School Cases, and I came upon a chart that showed me that the life expectancy in China had dropped by about 8 years.
It's a huge drop.
To the early 90s, and I don't know what the current status of that is, but that's my question.
Let's pick it up. Qi Ye in Beijing, what about the public health effects of the environmental problems China is facing and around life expectancy in particular?
Well, that number for 8 years of drop sounds quite astonishing to me, and
it
never heard of it yet. But the health impact is certainly there. Whether or not it affects the life expectancy is a different issue. And earlier you talked about the cancer rate and also respiratory diseases. That is quite common. And you go to all these bigger and medium-sized cities, And I do not really know the exact number, the exact impact of that on life expectancy.
President Bush this week has been talking about countries that are trying to get a free ride on the environment. He mentioned China and India in particular. Do you think China has been taking a free ride, not investing in a cleaner environment, looking for high growth instead at the expense of its own people and maybe the world? Is that a fair charge, Xi Ye?
I think certainly some of the factories and taking free ride and, you know, in terms of dealing with externalities. But as a nation, I think that is something very hard to understand. I mean, that term, free ride, I do not really know what President Bush mean. And, you know, as earlier I mentioned, if you talk about the free ride, so, you know, 20% of the energy that China burns is really burned for the United States.
To manufacture for Americans.
Right, that saved energy to be burned in the United States. Right, so if you think about that way, that 20% can be considered as a free ride, I guess. But
all those cheap products come at a price, and some of that price paid right here. Xi Ye in Beijing, thank you very much for being with us this hour. Yang Fuchan with me in Shanghai, and Zhang Jingjing in Hong Kong. Aaron Brockovich of China, good luck in your work. Thank you so much for it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point in Shanghai.